From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Egypt is the political linchpin of the Arab world. Its importance to the region was underscored yet again yesterday when Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Alexandria to discuss political solutions for peace in the Middle East. The North African nation of 70 million people contains within it a variety of extremes. One-third of all Egyptians are less than 15 years old. The Radical Muslim Brotherhood claims to be the second most powerful political party in the country. Egypt is at once potentially volatile, yet stable. It has regular elections, but it's not quite a democracy, and it's one of America's closest regional allies. With the Middle East under global scrutiny, the West expects Egypt to blaze a trail of moderation across the Arab world. But can it? This hour, from Alexandria to Aswan, a close look at democracy in Egypt. We begin in Cairo, in the failed appeal of Saad Idin Ibrahim. The internationally known Egyptian human rights advocate was sentenced to 7 years hard labor last week. The 62-year-old Ibrahim's conviction rekindled concern that the Egyptian government is trying to silence political activists around the country. Earlier, I spoke with Khaled Daoud, an Egypt correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper. I asked him to describe the latest developments in Saad Ibrahim's case.
The latest is that Dr. Saad al-Din Ibrahim is now in prison nearly 10 days after the sentence was issued, and his lawyers are still waiting for the court to release the reasons for its harsh sentence so that they can appeal later in front of the country's highest criminal court, which is the Court of Cassation.
Were people surprised by the fact that he was sentenced to 7 years? When I was in Cairo in the autumn, I think a lot of people felt that on appeal, this case would not stand up.
Well, after attending the retrial of Dr. Ibrahim, there was a feeling among most lawyers and journalists that he was going to get some sort of sentence. But the hope was that he'd get maybe like 1 or 2 years maximum, so that it would be considered sort of a compromise between the government's attitude towards condemning Mr. Ibrahim and the fact that the case is rather weak. And considering that he's already spent nearly 1 year in prison, so some people were hoping that he'd be convicted, but at the same time released in case the sentence was like rather little, 1 year or slightly more than that. But to sentence him to 7 years was rather shocking, especially that the judge tried to show some understanding during the proceedings. He gave time to all sorts of lawyers and witnesses to sort of defend Mr. Ibrahim. But in the end, the case sort of concluded in the same way like the first time. Suddenly the judge issued his sentence to 7 years, and Mr. Ibrahim was taken back to prison again.
Just very quickly, remind us of the basis of the case.
There's been several charges against Mr. Ibrahim, but the main one is that he has received money without government permission from the European Union in order to finance a program aimed at encouraging Egyptians to take part in elections. He was also accused of issuing reports that allegedly tarnish Egypt's image abroad. These reports mainly dealing with human rights and the status of Coptic Christians here in this country. And he was also accused of sort of embezzlement, or basically cheating the European Union by presenting them with false documents to justify the spending of the grant that he has received from them.
And of course, he denies all charges.
He's denied all charges since day one, and not only that, but also the European Union itself, the European Commission, has issued several statements confirming that they were happy with Dr. Ibrahim's work and that their own editors did not find any wrongdoing in the way he spent the money. But still, the Egyptian government convicted him over this business of violating a military decree issued in 1992, which bans Egyptians from receiving money from abroad without government permission.
How would you describe Saad Ibrahim's position in Egyptian society?
Saad al-Din Ibrahim, to a certain extent, is more well-known abroad, I would say, than he's known here in Egypt among ordinary Egyptians. Mr. Ibrahim was a pioneer in terms of raising human rights issues in Egypt and also establishing contacts with similar human rights organizations abroad, and also getting funds from abroad in order to finance important projects in Egypt, like those in human rights, women empowerment, respect of the rights of minorities. These were all rather new subjects in Egypt when he started in the early 90s. And that's why, you know, he's more known abroad than in Egypt. And that's why probably you'll find a stronger outcry in the United States, the being a dual Egyptian-American national and in Europe due to his contacts with Europe rather than a strong reaction here in Egypt.
How has this trial been reported, and does it really have any effect on public opinion in Egypt?
I think one point which has sort of harmed Mr. Ibrahim's position during this trial was the portrayal of his case as being that of a human rights activist supported by the West who has no support in Egypt. Unfortunately, during his trial, there were more foreign diplomats from European countries and from the United States than local Egyptian human rights groups, which at the same time emphasized the point of these human rights groups that Ibrahim's case is a warning to them, that the Egyptian government does not want to see people like Ibrahim who issue very strongly worded reports telling the truth about the status of human rights and the status of elections here in Egypt. And that's why many human rights activists right now are reconsidering how they should deal with the government and their work here in Egypt.
And if you went to the Khan al-Khalili Bazaar and went into a shop and spoke to a shopkeeper and said, "Isn't it terrible what's happened to Sadeddin Ibrahim?" What would that shopkeeper say to you?
I think that depends largely on the coverage of the government-owned press and the Egyptian television, and he would maybe reiterate some of the government's claims that Mr. Ibrahim is a so-called spy or that he's actually tarnishing Egypt's image by speaking about discrimination which the Coptic Christian minority here has been subjected to. Unfortunately, there aren't many free outlets for media here in Egypt that would allow the average Egyptian to sort of know exactly the nature of the charges, and he only listens to the government side. So I think that his reaction is going to be much less than that of the American and the European press that we're seeing right now.
Khaled Dawood, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Khaled Dawood is Egypt correspondent for Britain's Guardian newspaper. He spoke with me earlier from Cairo. On Point listeners, we're talking tonight about Egypt. We're talking about democracy in Egypt. What's more important for that country, stability or civil society? What's more important for the U.S.? Does Egypt have the social foundation in place to deal with democracy as we in the West define it? Can it be a moderate leader in a volatile Arab world? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Yusuf Ibrahim, who is no relation to Sadeddin Ibrahim. He's a senior fellow of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening, Yusuf.
Good evening.
Now, you were just listening to that debrief I had with Khaled Dawood. What do you make of the Sadeddin Ibrahim case?
I think it's a very sad decision, and I think it's a as the days and the months pass, prove to be a very serious error by the Egyptian government. Sadeddin Ibrahim is one thing, and cracking down on extreme Muslim fundamentalists is another thing. Egypt does need a little more liberalization, a little more openness, and a further advance towards democracy. And all of these things were advocated by Sadeddin Ibrahim. But I would like to add a little comment as to the reasons I believe why Sadeddin Ibrahim has ended up in jail, and for the tenacity of President Hosni Mubarak personally in keeping him there. Sadeddin Ibrahim was doing all of these things that were described by the gentleman who just spoke for a long time. And in fact, they were widely tolerated by the government, and he had many friends in the government. He also met with President Mubarak on several occasions. The president would call him in for conversations. In other words, the government was winked at what Sadeddin Ibrahim was doing, wasn't too happy about it, but the problem of Sadeddin Ibrahim occurred immediately over a subject that is highly sensitive in Egypt. Upon the death of President Hafez al-Assad, Sadeddin Ibrahim was making a television commentary on one of the Arab satellite stations. And it was a commentary on the funeral processions and on the future of what's going to happen in Syria. And at some point, They were taking questions. And one of the questions that came from one of the viewers was, do you believe something like this, meaning that the son of the president would become the president, could happen in Egypt? And he answered by saying that, well, it's always possible to see a scenario in which a group of parliamentarians would get together, nominate Gamal Mubarak, who is the most visible son of the president, to become the next president, and therefore, according to the Egyptian constitution, a process would start that would end up that way. I believe he was arrested almost immediately after making that statement.
But it's interesting, Yusuf, because what you described there, and when I add up what we heard from Khaled Daoud, is that you have someone who was advocating perhaps a more rapid turn towards a more purely participatory form of democracy than currently exists in Egypt, and that in and of itself might have, perhaps put a little flag next to his name, but he was tolerated because he's Egyptian-American, he has many good, positive foreign contacts, but then he crossed the red line, but the red line was the straight-up autocratic bent of President Hosni Mubarak, and by even implying that Mubarak intends to pass on the presidency by right of, primogeniture to his oldest son, that was a kind of criticism Mubarak couldn't tolerate. But what's interesting is that since the colonels overthrew King Farouk, and that happened 50 years ago this summer, I think, so we have an anniversary.
That is the 50th anniversary.
So we're celebrating a major anniversary. Have there been any other political parties in power? I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, we use the word democracy, but maybe you could characterize it in comparison to other kinds of democracies.
Well, there has certainly been a significant amount of liberalization in the transition from Gamal Abdel Nasser, who is the leader of the Egyptian revolution that overthrew the monarchy, of which several army officers were part of, including Anwar Sadat, who succeeded them, and including on a very junior position, Mubarak himself. So this is the same army that actually overthrew the monarchy and turned Egypt into a republic. Hence the sensitivity of that question, that in a way Egypt is making a full circle and is becoming no different from Syria or Libya or Yemen, where all the presidents in these countries have already given rule to their sons, as in Syria, or are about to do this, as in the other two. And Egyptians have always looked upon themselves as something above and better than the rest of the Arab world. There is a bit of hubris here and a little sort of arrogance, but it is based on the historical and cultural role that Egypt swings in the region as a leader. And that's the red line. I mean, he crossed the red line by saying, I think it's happening here. Now, a lot of people in Egypt whisper that it is happening here. Indeed,
do you think it is happening in Egypt?
I have a great difficulty actually accepting that could be the outcome. But there are several facts you cannot ignore. To begin with, everybody who knows Gamal Mubarak, I only met him once, but other people have met him many times, unquestionably think very highly of him. He is a sophisticated economist.
Yusuf, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're actually coming up to a break.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is, when we come back from the break, talk a bit more about the reality of what democracy means in the Arab Republic of Egypt. And we want to ask callers to call in and call Yusuf Ibrahim and our other guests with their questions about the country. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Call in, listeners. Find out more about Egypt. You're listening to On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt. We're talking the departure point was the sentencing last week of Saad Eddin Ibrahim, human rights advocate, democracy advocate, a man who is almost single-handedly got the civil society movement underway in Egypt, and he's been sent to 7 years hard labor. He's 62 years old. But we've moved on from there, and now we're looking at the state of democracy. We're going to try and define what it means in an Egyptian context. And I'd like to bring into the conversation to help us do that Larry Goodson, who's director of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And Larry Goodson spent a considerable chunk of the 1990s as a professor at the American University in Cairo. Good evening, Larry.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine. Why don't you just try and start the ball rolling on characterizing democracy. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot. Egypt would call itself a democracy, but it's perhaps a democracy not like others.
Well, it's not a democracy at all. It plays at having the trappings of democracy. It's sort of an authoritarian system that like many of the other Middle Eastern Arabic countries, has the outward vestiges of democracy, elections, parties, and so on. Now, compared to some of the other countries that Yusuf was just referring to, Syria and Libya and so on, Egypt is a bit freer in terms of its approach to the press, for example, or public discourse than some of the other places, Saad Eddin Ibrahim's case notwithstanding. But having said that, it's not a democracy at all. This is a country that Hosni Mubarak has ruled since the beginning of the 1980s. It's a country that's been under emergency rule since that time, so over 20 years now of emergency rule. The crackdown on Islamic fundamentalist challenge to the state in the early 1990s was quite severe, including military tribunals, extrajudicial killings, and the whole nine yards there. So it's not really a democracy. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Egypt, and the Egyptians are wonderful people, but this is not a country that really has a democracy, and we in the U.S., we sort of go along with the fiction that this is a country that's at least trying to transition in that direction because, of course, it's our second leading recipient of foreign aid. It's a major partner for the United States and the Middle East.
What's its strategic importance? Why is it getting a free pass on this?
Well, strategic importance grows, of course, in part out of its role in the Camp David process in the 1970s. It was the first of the Arab states under Sadat to recognize Israel and deal with Israel. The peace with Israel since then has been fairly frigid. It's routinely referred to as the cold or frozen peace in Cairo. But nonetheless, that has made Egypt an important partner for the United States. It is, of course, the country of the Suez Canal, which is still an important waterway for navies transiting, at least the smaller ships anyway, transiting to and from the Mediterranean into the Red Sea and down to the Arabian Sea and Indian Ocean. And it's also always, and I think Yusuf mentioned this as well previously, sort of seen itself as the leader of the Arab world. Now, most of the other Arab countries don't really see the Egyptians this way, but Egypt sees itself as a pivotal country, as the leading Arab country, not only the host of the Arab League, but also with in Cairo, the largest city, not only in the Middle East, but also in Africa and Europe. Egyptians see themselves as sort of the main center to Arab culture and the Arab world, and we have sort of helped them in that view by, if you will, sort of coddling the Egyptian regime all these years.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know that that sentiment, but I think that in America, because of the way the last 30-odd years have gone, that people, if they think of the center of the Arab world, they would think of Saudi Arabia primarily because of the oil.
I agree with you. And the Saudis certainly feel that way as well. There's always been this contest between the Saudis and the Egyptians. This also grows out of the period of Gamal Abdel Nasser, when, as far and away the most charismatic leader of his generation of Arab leaders in the 50s and 60s, he sort of laid claim through his Arab socialism, his ideology, which was somewhat popular in some of the Arab states, to leadership elsewhere in the Arab world. And Egypt has always had pretensions, if you will, to that role. And with the growth of the oil wealth, the Saudis especially, as well as, of course, being home to Mecca and Medina, the holy sites, have contested that claim somewhat. But still, Egypt feels that it is, that at the end of the day, everyone must come to Cairo.
I want to interrupt you, Larry, but we have a slight problem here because you're in Carlisle and Yusuf is in New York and I'm here and we're all frightfully polite adults. Yusuf, do you want to add anything to what Larry has been saying, or do you want to disagree with him? Feel free.
Not really. I can't disagree with him. AUC is my alma mater, so we are speaking in the family here. And I was the editor of the campus paper, which he knows very well.
Caravan.
And founder, I might add. I think maybe the premise of the question makes the answer difficult. Democracy, I was going to say pseudo-democracy, but I agree. Of course, it's not. But the space for personal freedom that exists in Egypt has expanded considerably from the time I was in my last year at the American University in Cairo, for example, in 68.
Is that based on improved economic circumstances?
No, it was based on essentially a change in leadership. And after Sadat established a token opposition, and Mubarak allowed it to expand further. In other words, you could be arrested for making a bad joke about Nasser in 1968. Today, that's not a problem about Mubarak. You have a bigger. You couldn't travel. I couldn't actually take my scholarship at Columbia University and leave the country in 68 without the pulling some strings. Today, Egyptians are free to travel. So I would say also the standard of living of Egyptians has risen, but the quality of life has dropped dramatically. Egyptians can go to university because it's free, but the quality of the education in the university has considerably deteriorated. So I think democracy is not really the right question, but there certainly is more room for debate in Egypt.
Yusuf, I'm going to interrupt you because I would like to bring a caller into the discussion now. Noor is on the line.
Hello, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
My name is Noor, and I'm an American Egyptian, and I would like to just give you a brief history about my life. I lived almost 29 years in Egypt since I born, and as an American citizen, I'm very proud to be an American citizen. And I see that Egypt is completely far from democracy. And the reason why I'm saying that, I don't see different parties. It's only one party, which is the government party, and there's a lot of forgery, especially in the when the election time comes, and there's a lot of eyewitnesses from the country itself, from Egypt themselves, they have witnessed a lot of forgery, and this is this is really a shame. I think the Egyptian government has to get more closer to democracy, and I see that the human rights in Egypt that has been really, I don't know how to explain it, but I would say that almost I would say that, you know, most of the Egyptian people, they don't have any rights to speak up. And this is my comment.
Noor, I want to thank you for that comment. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jay is on the line. Jay.
Good evening, Michael. It's good to have you back to Boston. You are the voice of reason. As a matter of fact, Michael, not long ago, you had a very good report from the entire world, the Islamic world, and you had a chance to go to Egypt. And in fact, the policeman was trying to grab your microphone in Cairo.
Yes, it's true. On my last Friday, I thought I'd go up and just record the sound of the muezzin at Friday prayers. But and I thought, well, I know enough Arabic now, which is to say, you know, shukran, which is thank you, and that I would be able to record. Nobody would bother me. But the minute I took that beast out and started pointing it, I was calmly told to leave. Unless I had certain papers, and I didn't have them with me. So that did happen, yes.
And,
so
what, yes. And the difference is that Said Adin Ibrahim is a U.S. Egyptian citizen, but you, on the other hand, were born here. They couldn't keep you there. But the funny part of the whole thing is, I'm sure you probably read the article from Tom Friedman this past Sunday.
Yes, indeed.
And boy, can he ever write. I mean, this was great comment from the State Department that they were just disappointed. But more importantly, the America pays $2 billion to keep Egypt for what? And if they're trying to maintain, I guess, democracy, and the democracy is Hosni Mubarak's way, since Hosni Mubarak is the president, in fact, we had king change hand in Saudi Arabia and Jordan, but Mubarak is still there as a president. This is the most funny democracy that anybody known.
Do you have a question, Jay? This is what we've been on about for the last 5 minutes. Do you have a question that you want to throw to either Larry Goodson or Yusuf Ibrahim about this?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And my question is this. How come U.S. State Department keeps silence? They don't say much about what happened to Said Adin Ibrahim.
Yusuf, Larry, either one of you.
It's a conundrum, and
Yusuf Ibrahim.
The reason the State Department and indeed all of us have to tread carefully here is what happens if Egypt, in fact, does move to a complete transparent democracy. I'm sure our callers know as well as I do and you do that if we have a free election in Egypt, the party that will win this election will be the Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, the Islamic extremist fundamentalist mother party. And it will be, without any question, the last free election you will have in Egypt. And this is the same dilemma we are facing in the Arab world. We say we would like to have democracy, but in fact these governments have so mismanaged the streets and mismanaged the economy that the only parties that were always present supplying services and so on and so forth were the Islamic parties, and as a result of this, plus the natural appeal of Islam after the collapse of Nasserism and Arab nationalism would be the winners, and Islamists simply do not believe in a peaceful change of government.
Larry Goodson, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. You can see the quality of the education my former institution, AUC, used to give our
that's the American University
our
of Cairo.
Graduates there. No, I completely agree. The problem that that they face in Egypt is that the National Democratic Party, which our previous caller Noor referred to not by name, the party of the president, the dominant party in Egypt. It wins every election. In this last election, it took about 90% of the seats that were up for grabs in the parliament. It really isn't that popular. In fact, most of its candidates in the 2000 elections lost to independent candidates, who then immediately announced after the election that they were, in fact, going to be NDP representatives in the parliament. In a sense, there was a sort of anti-government vote that in a free and fair election would undoubtedly go as it did in Algeria and elsewhere where this has occurred. Jordan is another example, to Islamic fundamentalists in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood has done quite well, for example, in syndicate elections, which were free in the middle part of the early and middle part of the 1990s. These were elections. Syndicates are like associations or labor unions in the United States. So you have the engineers, the teachers, the doctors, and so on. And in those elections for the board of directors, as well as for student unions or student governments at the major Egyptian universities, the Brotherhood candidates almost always won, until, again, the government began to crack down on those. And the problem that I'm sort of trying to get at here, and which Yusuf also got at already, is that in restricting people's ability to express themselves, to actually have democracy, people turn to the alternative that persists despite all of this, which is the rather radical fundamentalist response to all of this, rather than to the kind of more moderate parties that we would actually like to see exist in this country.
Michael, sometimes I think the best solution is the Chinese solution or the Korean solution. You remember, Egypt is simply not ready for democracy. Many people don't even know what the meaning of democracy is because they're too poor. And what we need to do, the United States, that's the role that we can play, the role we are not playing, is to keep the pressure to liberate the economy. What you need to do is raise the standard of living. And as you raise the standard of living, allow institutions to exist, chambers of commerce, clubs of investors, and so on and so forth. And once you reach a certain point, as we have seen in South Korea, the transition becomes possible to democracy. It is no longer viewed as dangerous. The Chinese are really following this model. The Russians, the Soviet Union, the ex-Soviet Union didn't, and they collapsed. And I almost think that this has got to be the solution. You have got we give aid, and our aid should be targeted to
economic to commercial development. Let's not say
liberalize, privatize. Give the power,
Yusuf?
Because when you do this, you really transform.
I've got to cut you off because we're coming up to the break. We're going to pick up this topic just after the break. We're talking about Egypt. We're talking about how it can be guided into true modernity. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Mo is on the line. Mo?
Hello?
Hello, Mo?
Hi.
Hi, you're on Point.
Okay, I'm just asking, you know, which kind of the democracy you're talking about? You're talking about the Western or just Middle East democracy? Because, you know, there is no compare between. That's the point I want to ask, you know.
The Western style or Middle Eastern one? Let me put that question, Mo, to both of my guests. Is there a way of defining Middle Eastern democracy, or is it just too much of a contradiction in terms?
Michael, this is Larry.
Yeah, Larry.
I'll get at that, but let me just add something to what Yusuf was saying before the break, which was this notion of sort of economic development raising everyone's boats and in Egypt and presumably elsewhere in the region, and kind of creating conditions or preconditions for, I guess we would call, Western democracy. This has been a model that was pursued in Egypt in the 1990s. There's a great deal of interest in the South Korean experience, for example. I'm not sure that the evidence that we've seen in the last several years is that this has really worked very well. I wouldn't want to get into political culture arguments about whether, you know, the Arab world is somehow has a political culture that isn't conducive to democracy. But I would say that I think Egypt is not has a culture that's not especially conducive to democracy. This is an area of the world where, I wouldn't say it's an especially authoritarian political culture. I do think that it is maybe a fairly apathetic political culture. They're more or less comfortable with the status quo. They're not convinced they can do much to change it. And a lot of people are kind of complicit in the existing system, however flawed it might be. As for the difference between Western and Middle Eastern democracy, in academic terms, this sort of turns on the difference between what the Lebanese perceive their democracy to be, which is a sort of consociational or group-based democracy, where different groups are represented in government. In the Middle East, many of the societies are very group-oriented in terms of the families and so on that people have identity with. However, most of the Western scholars who work on democracy see democracy as having very clear criteria requiring, you know, free elections and individual rights to vote and individual freedoms and so on. And the Middle Eastern countries, as well as countries in other parts of the world, frequently fall short on those indicators. And that's the standard that I would be looking at personally.
The late Iranian philosopher Yosef Ali Abadeh wrote rather eloquently last year about the Enlightenment and what that had meant in the West as a couple of centuries of fighting and arguing that led suddenly in the late 17th century to the writings of John Locke and a consensus about what it meant to be a citizen in the world, stepped away from the church and your responsibilities to your fellow citizens and from this democracy could grow. And he pointed out that that process of enlightenment had yet to happen throughout the Islamic countries of the Middle East, and that it was almost impossible to expect to be able to impose democratic notions or even encourage people towards it until the societies themselves, individual citizens of the societies, had come to, you know, a different arrangement of what it meant to be a citizen.
Well, in addition to that, Michael, as Yusuf mentioned a few minutes ago, there's also a real I think he called it quality of life problem. You know very well from having been in Cairo that all the trappings of Western modernity are there. The fancy cars, the McDonald's, the latest movies from Hollywood and so on.
And mobile telephones.
And all sorts of cellular telephones are certainly available. And the young elites, the rich, the cream of the upper class, they have access to all of that, as do some of the people the next couple of steps down the ladder. But the vast majority of the Egyptian population still are mired in, for what is in the Arab world, fairly abject poverty. And for most of those people in the Delta, along the Nile, and in the slums of Shubra el-Khaimah and some of the districts around Cairo, those people are concerned about their sort of daily livelihood. For them, democracy is a luxury, and they can't really get into the philosophical arguments that we would make about you know, the rights of man or that sort of thing.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Heather is on the line.
Hi, Michael. Hi. Great for you to be here.
Thanks.
Tonight. We are hearing so much about how the road to Riyadh is through Baghdad, and I really want to know what changes in Iraq would mean for the Egyptians. Is it possible that Mahfouz could be right and we have a fine liberal democracy, or things will things go very much more worse for Egypt?
Heather, let me just ask you, if I'm understanding your question, are you asking what effect would going to war in Iraq have on Egypt?
Yes.
On the regime of Mubarak?
Yes.
Let me throw that first to Yusuf Ibrahim.
It all depends what the Egyptian the regime decides to do. I think cooperation at this point, 1990 style, with the United States in any military action against Baghdad would almost spell the end of the regime. Already, I think there is within the Egyptian armed forces a considerable amount of dissatisfaction and discomfort at the events going on in the occupied territories and in West Bank and with Israel. Any attempt to participate in what is seen as increasing the hardships of the Iraqi people with whom the Egyptians now have come to bond would be very serious. Now, I suspect the Egyptians have been saying, both in private and in public, exactly the same thing the Saudis have been saying, which is, count us out. Unless you resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before, or at least dampen that fire, we are not prepared to participate in any campaign in Baghdad. The other fear, of course, is every Arab regime would like to see Saddam Hussein go. Nobody likes Saddam Hussein, and certainly the Iraqi people will be on the front line. The question is, we've been through that once before, and we let them down at the last minute. And secondly, it's been 10 years, and during these 10 years, the suffering of the Iraqi people has come to be seen as the same as the suffering of the Palestinian people, and it all has come to be seen as a sort of American Western conspiracy to against the quote-unquote Arab nation. There's a lot of changes happened since 1990, and there is furthermore something new in this picture now called the Arab satellite revolutions, which gives access to the poorest Egyptian, Algerian, Moroccan, or Yemeni direct access above the head of their governments into what's happening, into free debates, into programs that ask open questions like, why is the government corrupt? It's a dicey situation today to go along with you.
I just want to throw a last question to Larry Goodson, because we're assuming that you're still there, Larry. Are you there?
Sorry. I think I hit some buttons here.
Okay. We've pretty much talked through democracy, and Heather threw a very good question, which is, what would be the likely effect be on the Mubarak regime if the U.S. were to unilaterally get involved in a war with Iraq? How should the U.S. approach Egypt in the coming months and years, do you think? And that's a big question, and I haven't given you much time to answer it.
There's two sides to the coin. On the one hand, the Egyptians are mistrustful of the West, and Al Jazeera and the satellite options are perhaps opening new doors to the Egyptian population. You know very well, Cairo is a city of satellite dishes. But most of the Egyptians have grown up with a culture that is deeply full of conspiracy theories and doubts and uncertainties about the outside world in a media environment where the government controls everything. And so there is this perception of the West as somehow, led by the U.S., as somehow behind all of what's going on in the Middle East and sort of responsible for that. The flip side of that is, of course, that Egypt is considered, correctly or not, by the U.S. as its number one or maybe number two Arab ally.
Larry Goodson.
And we are going to expect them to be there for us if we go after Iraq.
I've got to interrupt you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And thanks to our callers, Noreen, Jay, and Heather. Thank you all.
Thank you.
In a moment, an American looks back on her first few weeks living in Jerusalem. This is On Point. From her home in New Hampshire, independent producer Nahani Rouse watched the violent Israeli-Palestinian conflict escalate. After moving to Jerusalem a few weeks ago, she's amazed at how such attacks have become integrated into the daily lives of Israelis. In this radio diary, Rouse reflects on her first few weeks of living as an American in Israel.
I arrived in Israel a little over 3 weeks ago. I came for the stories, came to find out what Ramallah really looks like, what makes children happy, what people do in their spare time, how the heat feels. I came because I was tired of just reading the newspaper every day. I was tired of everybody talking about a place very few had ever seen. I wanted to know, and I wanted to be able to tell people back home what was really going on. The funny thing is, when I first arrived, I felt like I knew less about what was happening here than I did when I was at home. At home, newspapers and radio give us a narrative. Even if it's confusing, it has a finite number of words. I had stepped into the story, and suddenly there were no headlines. Jerusalem was no longer a word printed in English. It was the sound of live voices all around me. Stone buildings, pavement, traffic lights, and people. People working, carrying groceries, people bringing their children to school, shouting into cell phones, sitting together in the evenings to enjoy the cooler air. People just living. I arrived in a relatively quiet period. Bit by bit, I tried out my Hebrew. I bought the wrong kind of cottage cheese. I came home with paper towels instead of toilet paper. I understood about 2% of the news. Arafat, Sharon. My neighbor reprimanded me for going without a hat in the middle of the day. He's an old man from Poland who works in his garden and writes poetry. He told me I could read it, but it would make me cry. One day I ventured into the old city. An Arab shopkeeper gave me coffee with cardamom and somehow guessed that I was from Boston. I got used to guards checking my bag at the door to every store and cafe. When an attack in the north broke the calm, I didn't even know until my aunt called from New Hampshire. Last week was a hard week. It seemed like there was an attack every day, and every night I would watch news of Israel's retaliation. But children were still laughing and riding their scooters on the sidewalk, and teachers were still teaching, and my neighbor was still watering his flowers. Sometimes it's the normalcy here that feels odd. I'm not afraid walking down the street, but I shiver when I think of the tiny decisions that determine who is sitting in the wrong place at the wrong time. I wonder how people overcome this sense of precariousness. My Israeli cousin tells me she believes in fate, but fate is inhuman and repugnant. Last week, a man I know lost the woman he was going to marry. One minute she was eating lunch at Hebrew University. Then a backpack exploded, and now she's gone. Nobody can understand this. All we can do is stay close to the people who are left behind. I keep promising myself that I won't try to make all the pieces fit together, that I won't try to send home neatly wrapped packages. I will just keep looking, listening, and gathering stories. Almost everyone here has lost someone, and there is simply no narrative that can hold all that pain. This is a place where people, even enemies, are woven together in ways they don't understand. I woke up in the dark early one morning to hear a muezzin calling the Muslims to prayer in East Jerusalem. It was a human voice, and I was stunned by its mournfulness and its closeness and the way it had nearly carried itself into my dream.
Nahani Rouse is an independent producer, now living in Jerusalem. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, you'll email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...